The convention's this weekend. J.D.'s putting the suit on. He's trying it on. They had to alter it to fit him. And he said, you know, it fits real good. Tip, wait, there's something wadded up here in the pocket. And he pulled out a $20 bill, a $10 bill, and a $5 bill out of the pocket. Now, you know how we like to put God in a box and tell him how to do it? I would never thought to tell him to do it that way. And we cried. We sit there and we held each other in our arms and cried. We couldn't believe how good God was to us. We were going to get to go. And we went. Now we've got our cheese and our crackers. And did you know that there'd be this couple or that couple would come and say, why don't y'all come and go to lunch with us? Let us treat you. Let us take you to supper. Came the big night of the banquet. And God, the banquet tickets were $25 a piece or something. It's some ungodly amount of money. And we were sitting in our room about to have an attack of self-pity. In Arkansas, they don't have closed circuit TV in the rooms like they do at the Cornhusker, I can tell you, you know. That is one super convention. I think that's one of the neatest things. But anyway, we're sitting there in the room, and all of a sudden you heard a bumping at the front door. And I went over there, and there was an envelope laying in the floor, and we opened it, and there were banquet tickets. We got to do everything there was to do. God took care of it, and we don't know to yet who did that. And it's not important who did that. What's important is that God showed us that if we took the steps and did what we were supposed to do, that he'd come right in there and give us whatever was necessary when we became willing to accept it either way. You see, we were willing to sit in the room and eat crackers and cheese because we were so happy to be a part of a convention of Alcoholics Anonymous. I try on that third step. I love the third step prayer in the big book. I love that prayer. And I start my day with that. And it's sort of like saying, God, here I am. I'm showing up for duty. What you want me to do for you today? Instead of, I used to say, God, I want you to do this for me today. It's real funny. I used to ask God to rubber stamp my plan. I had it all planned out, and then I'd tell him about it, and I'd say, now, God, this is what I want. Now, God, I want you to give Tina a new car, and I want you to give Richard a better house, and I want you to make Debbie's husband okay, and I want you to do that. I don't do that anymore. I found it's much more simple for me if I just say, God, your will be done in those lives that I love, because I know you love them more than I do. And God, your will be done in my life, and help me to accept it. Because, you know, I don't know the difference between good and bad, do you? Because the worst things I thought that could possibly happen to me in my life, like J.D.'s alcoholism, how about J.D. losing his job for such a long period of time? You'd be surprised what I learned in that over 6 months that J.D. was unemployed. I learned that a lot of things that I thought were necessities were not. I learned that material things do not keep you warm at night, and to worry about paying for them is not worth them. I've got a couch I call my spite couch at home. I have it just to spite myself. Because I went out in my arrogance and bought a couch I couldn't afford. And I was even, the worst thing about going out and buying something when you're an impulsive spender like I am, is that you don't ever take anybody with you. Because if you do, you will spend three times as much to show them you can. And that's what I had done. And so I literally went without lunches for a period of months in order to make those couch payments. And I hate that damn couch, but I keep it to show myself, see what you can do. And you see, it's such a good couch, you know, special made at the factory, it'll never wear out. But I'm grateful I have that couch. So you see, I had to develop that God of my understanding. And it's true, you know, the big book says, as we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, we discovered we could face life successfully. As we became conscious of God's presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, and the hereafter. We were reborn. This step for me, the third step, is where I give God a blank check. A blank check on my life for him to do with as he sees fit. Trusting and knowing that the best is going to be for me. Because the worst things have turned out to be the best, and many times what I thought were the best things have turned out to be the biggest stumbling blocks I've ever had. So since I don't know the difference, I just ask God to help me to accept what comes my way. Because I still have a problem accepting. Because I still have a lot of self-will. and what I want and how I want it. I'm real bad with that. So that's where I have to continually keep going back and humbling myself and asking this power to help me. J.D. needed a truck or a vehicle of some kind. When he was drinking, you know, we had got down to his drunk truck, and this was an old 50 GMC. He called it his antique, his classic. It was a junky truck. And when you got in it, the only way you kept the doors on was you got one of these little bungee cords and stuck it in the windows and hung it in the ashtray. And that's how you kept the doors on when you went around the corner. Classic. And so it had to be jump-started every time you started it. There was no other way. And he was going to be working night. And he said, you know, I don't see these guys at 3 and 4 in the morning wanting to stay in the parking lot after they work a long shift, wanting to jump the truck. And I said, I'm not getting up to come do it. And I had to go to work right after he got home, but he had to go before I left, so we couldn't use the same car. It was just a mess. And so I said, we'll turn it over to God. Don't you love that? And I turned it over to God, and then I worried. The reason I turned it over to God was I had no idea what to do with it. As long as, you know, for a long time, when I tell you I'd let go and let God, you knew then I had tried everything I knew to do first. I can do that a lot easier now. I don't have to do a lot of that mess like I used to. But anyway, I prayed about it, and J.D. prayed about it, and then we went out and we looked. Well, this was when the gas was first getting real expensive and everything, and we decided that we needed one of those little economy type things, and he wanted a truck. So we went down and we looked at all the Datsuns and Toyotas and all the little bitty Chevrolets and Ford things that they had out, and we wanted just a plain vanilla truck, just a heater and a transmission, just plain vanilla. There wasn't one. They all had four-wheel drive. They had stereo. They had air conditioning. They had all that stuff that cost lots of money. And they wouldn't order you a stripped-down lot. They would not do that. So there we were. Well, now, J.D.'s going to go to work next Monday night, and this is Friday, and we don't have a truck. We don't have anything for him to go to work in. And now I'm getting a little flaky. My sponsor said, she was always full of wisdom, like, God may be slow, but he's never late. And I said, well, I can tell you what, he's through the wire now. So I'm sitting there Friday night at the house. J.D.'s gone to his meeting, and all of a sudden the phone rang, and this person that I never dreamed in the world cared if I lived or died said, I hear you're having some problems and you need some transportation for J.D. And I said, yes, we do. And she said, well, would $2,000 help? And I said, no. There's no way we can pay back $2,000 and a car payment too. There's just, we've been, with him being off work as long as he was, we're playing catch up on bills now. We can't afford a big payment for a car payment. That's just it. She said, I don't remember using the word loan. She said, could you use the $2,000 as a love gift? Well, you know, one of the things that my sponsor had been telling me was to be able to say, thank you, and yes. And that's real hard on your pride. And I said, yes, thank you. So in a few minutes, I had $2,000 in cash sitting on my coffee table, and I was just looking at it. But we hadn't found the truck that we could afford yet. But we hadn't needed to yet. So Saturday, we took the money to the bank, deposited it, and went down to the car place again, making the little circuit one more time. Pulled right into the Datsun place, and there off all by itself was a little white, plain vanilla truck. And we asked the salesman about it, and he said, well now, Coca-Cola had ordered that, and we didn't get it in soon enough. Now they're refusing to take it, but you don't want it because you don't have anything but a transmission and a heater. And we said, oh? He said, well, could we drive it around the block? And he said, sure. So we got in it, we drove off and went, it's our truck! We drove back in and said, how much do you want for it? And he said, well, then they stripped down, they're paying $3,400 for a brand new truck. And they were selling for like $6,000 and $7,000 back then. And we said, well, we can do that. We paid that $2,000 down. Our payments was like $60 a month for a year. Well, it's nothing. We could afford that. And guess what? They said, we'll service it and have it ready for you Monday afternoon. And he went to work Monday night. It was just in time. God wasn't late. Had me worried there for a minute. and we call that our God truck. We've never found it necessary to add the stereo, to add the fancy stuff to it. We've been very grateful that God gave it to us just the way it was, and we've been real happy. And you know, there's something funny about that truck. It lasts longer than normal trucks. We drove on the factory tires for 5 years before they had to be replaced. It's not had very little maintenance. All we hear, God takes, that's God's truck. And that's like J.D., he gave his job to God. We've given the truck to God. We give these things to God, and then they're his responsibility. It just works out so much better. We do whatever we have to do. You know, when I turn my will and my life over to God and say you don't know what to do, do what's right in front of you to do. You know, you're not every day of your life you're going to have a big job to do for God. Sometimes it's clean the house. You know, it doesn't have to be these great big things. Just do what's right in front of you. I like to say, God, help me to know your will for my life today. Help me not to push you aside, and help me not to stand in your way. And we are now at step four, where we will continue tomorrow. How are you doing? Survivors! Died already? There's no hope. No hope whatsoever. I want to thank you for coming back. You know, I'm always surprised to see them come back. This shows me you're fiends for punishment. My name is Mary Pearl, and I am an Al-Anon who's happy, joyous, and free. Hi, everybody. I want to just briefly touch on 1, 2, and 3 to get us sort of started into 4 today. In the first step, we recognize that we are powerless and that what we're doing isn't working. I think that's the basic thing I need to remember in step 1, that what I'm doing isn't working. Whenever I allow what other people do, say, whatever, to upset me, I am back at 1 because I am trying to get them to do it my way. So whenever you feel that discomfort, that disease, that's because we're back at 1. We're not getting our way. Now, my way never worked. I don't know why I wanted my way. My way never worked. But you see, that's the insanity we talk about in step 2. That feeling that we know best when we don't. And that feeling that when we know best, we become a higher power. And the worst thing for me, rather than having you as my higher power, is having me as my higher power. Because I am in real bad trouble then. Okay, I came to believe that there was something out there that could possibly help me. That's all I have to have there, is the willingness to believe that there's something out there that will help me. And a third step is I tried to become a little more consciously aware and I practice a little acceptance in my life. Acceptance is really, really hard because basically I don't like to accept. Now, if I am going to ask this power to help me with my life, I'm going to have to be willing to do certain things. Now, all we've done up to this point is take a look at what our life has been. We have not taken any action. And I like to quote when they said, when I finished and I throw my sponsor, I said, well, I finally got step 3. And she said, thank God, now we can begin to work. You know, it had taken over a year to get to there. What was her problem, you know? And she said, no, we're going to see how willing you are. We're going to see how much you are sincere when you made that decision to live a different way. Because first we've got to find out what you're all about. What makes you tick? Not necessarily the good and the bad of you, but the truth about you. Uh-huh. And I said, well, that shouldn't be too hard. But now, you know, I'm the kind of person, if you ever watch Password, and they give you a clue, and then they remove one clue, and then you get the next clue. Well, that's the way they ought to do the steps, is they ought to keep them covered until you got one done. Because, see, I saw 5, and 5 kept me from doing 4, and I kept putting it off. Now, if you want to do 1, 2, 3, what I call the Al-Anon walks, you just go right ahead. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Hey, you ain't going to get a damn bit better because nothing's going to change, but you can 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. I always love it when you ask them, what step are you working on? Oh, I'm doing 1, 2, and 3 on a daily basis. Good for you. Because 1, 2, 3's all in my head. Ain't nothing changing. So, my sponsor said you're going to have to do a searching and fearless moral inventory. And here's where I ran over to the literature cabinet and I grabbed my trusty little blueprint for progress and one afternoon did it. And I didn't feel any different. I don't know about y'all, but I didn't feel any different. And I couldn't understand and I couldn't buy it. Now, the way I did this was yes, no, maybe sometimes, okay. But I didn't learn anything about me. And so I didn't get any relief from that. And so I went to, now I was one of those fortunate ones, because my sponsor is Lou Bell MC from Arkansas, and her husband is the Joe MC that goes around all over the world with the Big Book study. And Joe was working on that during that period of time, and we were always around one another, and he ran a Serenity House where he helped recovering alcoholics. And one day I was talking to Joe when I couldn't get a hold of Lou Bell. I don't know what kind of relationship you have with your sponsor. But when I couldn't get my sponsor, I asked anybody who was on the other end of that line. And he answered at their house. And I would say, Joe, what about this? And Joe, what about that? And I asked him one day, I said, what about this inventory? And he said, well, down at the treating house, we have a guide that we give recovering alcoholics. It's a questionnaire to sort of jog their memory because, you know, they have a lot of brain damage and a lot of blackouts and they can't remember. And I thought, yeah. I could relate to that. And you see, I thought my husband was like me. When they first used the term blackout, I didn't believe it. I said, if I'd done what you did, I wouldn't want to think about it either. And that's what I did. When I did something I didn't like, I didn't think about it much, and therefore it wasn't. So I needed something to help stimulate my little memory bank. And so that's what I did. He gave me this inventory, and it was confusing at first because it was all related to drinking and what have you. But when I got down to those feelings and answering some of those questions, I began to write. And I wrote the great American novel. I wrote how I wished it had been. Okay? Now, one of the instructions said to go back through that list and when you got through, and if you saw any areas where you had not quite told the truth, to tell the truth. So we had another inventory. But that one wasn't accurate either. Because I don't know about you, but I have a hard time with stuff. I would put down, I'll give you one for instance. Now, one of the things I didn't like about myself was that I was an unfaithful wife. Not a big deal in today's time, but back when I was growing up, you know, we had different sets of morals that were instilled on us. And one of those was that a woman got married and they stayed with that one particular person and was faithful and all like that. And I hadn't been. And so I had to justify why I did what I did. So, on my first inventory, it said, on my first go-round, my first rough draft, it said, I ran around on my husband because he ran around on me. And when I read that, I said, well, that's not exactly true. I ran around on my husband because I thought he was running around on me. And then I came back and I said, that's not exactly true. I ran around on my husband because I noticed all the other guys were running around and their wives when they were in a military base without their spouses. This seemed to be the thing to do, and he probably had, and this guy looked pretty good, so I thought maybe he had, so that's not true. I ran around because I wanted to. And that's how I had to do every damn thing on my inventory. Because I had lied and justified and rationalized what I did, so I didn't know what the truth was anymore. And I'd have to keep looking at it and praying about it. There's another thing I learned. You know, I've just established a relationship with God. And I'm scared because I'm afraid I'm going to find stuff that's going to make me unworthy again. So I put at the top of my sheet, God loves me. And down at the bottom, God still loves me. And then I'd turn the next page, and as I'd go. And this way, I realized that nothing that I was going to find in that inventory was going to keep my God from loving me. And that made it a lot easier. I found a lot of things to know why I didn't love me. And that was the purpose. Why? What is wrong with me that separates me from those good feelings? I can tell you, the things that separate you from your higher power are your character defects. Those are the things that when you practice them, if you're resentful, this will block your flow from your higher power. So I needed to know all these things about me that I seem to do that block me from receiving what I needed to get from my higher power. Now, I had a lot of fear. I had a lot of guilt. I had a lot of shame. I hated my mother. I'd say I had broken my marriage vows. I had failed as a wife. I was unable to be a mother. I had a lot of self-condemnation. I mean, I was in rotten shape, and they said, take an inventory and take a look. I didn't want to take a look at that. Why should you have to go back and dig up stuff that you did years ago? Why do you have to do that? I don't know why you do, but the reason I do is that I will function today based on those feelings I'm carrying around inside of me from yesterday. And if I've done something that I don't feel good about yesterday, it will color how I act and react today. Have you ever been around when, like say, you told a big lie and then somebody comes up and just says something, you're defensive? You ever be evasive? You just don't, you know, they'll ask you a question and they'll say, what did you do last night? God, isn't it beautiful out today? Well, what did you do last night? I got a new dress. Oh, did you go shopping? Oh, no, I just have a new dress. I thought I'd mention that. You'll be evasive. You'll go around these things because you don't want to tell what you did last night. You don't want to tell the truth because you know the truth. The truth will set you free. It'll also make you mad as hell. Every time I learned something about me, I didn't like it. And every time my sponsor would point something out to me, it would make me so mad at that woman, I hated her when she would do that. And I would tell her things. Like, for instance, I went to a meeting one night, and I was telling them how I had gone over to my mother's that day, and I hated my mother. And the more I was around her, I wanted to just take her neck and put it in my hands and squeeze it until her eyes popped out. And then I'd gone home, and with this feeling of love toward my mother in my heart, I had gone into the front closet to get something out, and this box of papers, our income tax stuff for the next year, fell on top of my head and filtered down through the closet. And how I ran amok, and I grabbed the umbrella, and I beat it to death. And my sponsor just sat there while I was going through this little thing, and I was so proud about the fact I'd beat the umbrella to death. Because see, what I wanted to tell him was that God knew I needed an umbrella because I went to the meeting, they had bingo, and I won an umbrella. And she looked at me and she said, when are you going to quit acting like a three-year-old? A three-year-old. And I looked at her and I said, don't talk to me. I'll never call you again in the X-Wing corridors of time. Drop dead, bitch. And I walked out and I went home. Boy, I was mad. And I sat there in that chair and I said, how could she say that? And then I began to think back of what I just said and what I just done, and I knew. And I tried so hard to prove her wrong, and I couldn't. So then the next day, see, I had to call her back and said, you know all that stuff I said yesterday? Well, you were right, and I was wrong. That's always been very difficult. Have you ever noticed how the words, I was wrong, just sort of go, and just sticking you out? And she said, you're going to have to grow up and quit acting like a child. She says, you're like a little spoiled child, and every time you don't get your way, you throw a fit. And I did. I was a fit thrower, and I was proud of those fits because I intimidated a lot of people with those fits. They would give me my way rather than to run the cost. What if she has a fit? She could rain all over you. And that umbrella was nothing compared to the physical violence I had been known to do to people. And so when I started doing this inventory, I looked back and I said, well, the only reason I was physically violent was because my husband drank and he came in, and the first time I was physically violent, I was 6 years old. I had a little girlfriend that had come down to the house. She said something I didn't like. I popped her in the mouth. She went home like a ninny. You know how crybabies are. She told my mama on the way out. And so my mama came in there and she told me, she said, you're going to have to go down and tell Shirley you're sorry. And I said, but I'm not. And she said, what do you mean? And I said, I'm not sorry. I did it because she deserved it. And she gave me a whipping and she said, now you go tell Shirley you're sorry. And I said, I'm not sorry. So she gave me another whipping, and I said, I'm not going down to tell Shirley I'm sorry because I'm not sorry, and she made me sorry. So I finally recognized that my mother was going to beat me to death if I didn't go down to Shirley's. So I went down to Shirley's, and I said, my mama said to tell you I'm sorry. That's physical violence. I was 6 years old. Now, I will say this. I was raised in physical violence after my daddy died. My mother's inability to deal with her anger was just like mine. And Mama didn't know how to deal with it. But you see, I can't blame it all on Mother because Daddy died when I was 12. So I had the predisposition to be that way because I was spoiled rotten. I was used to getting my way. And I think a lot of times people let me have my way. All my life people let me have my way because it was easier than suffering the consequences of when I didn't. And I knew that, and I played on it. Okay, I have another defect I found in that inventory, and that was I'm very self-righteous. I hate people who are physically violent. I look down on these people. And I'll say, well, at least I didn't do that. Haven't you noticed how you can look around the room and you see somebody come in and they say something and you say, well, I've never done that. So when I was doing my inventory, I found that my I'll-nevers begin to change as the years had gone by. And my standards had dropped a little from time to time. And I had had to seek lower companions in order to feel good about myself. Because I felt so bad about me that if I could look at you and say, aha, you do drugs. I don't do drugs. I may get drunk, but I don't do drugs. And I may sleep around, but I don't do drugs. This made me feel good about me. But the truth of the matter was the things I was doing was not making me feel good about me. And I had certain standards. I can remember, like I say, when I grew up, my standards were that I was going to be a good wife. I was going to be a faithful wife. And I was going to be a good mother. And I was going to be all of those things. And then, lo and behold, I was not a good wife. I was not a faithful wife. And I said, well, at least I will not commit adultery with a married man. Now, I don't know why this makes any difference. If you're married, adultery is adultery. But, you know, you have to have a standard. But I did. And so I said, well, at least I'll not commit adultery with a girlfriend's husband. But I did. My latest one, and I've had this one for quite some time, is I will not have an affair with a sheep. Excuse me. A kangaroo. Sheep are okay. Kangaroo. But I haven't gone to Australia yet either. I found that it's real hard to set goals because you have a tendency to overshoot your mark every time, you know. But that's what I found out when I was doing my inventory, that all these goals and standards that I had set for myself, one by one, I had not lived up to them, and that was some of the reason I didn't like me. Now, I had a lot of denial. I don't know if y'all have a lot of denial. But now, I'm sort of like the priest and the rabbi and the Al-Anon that went to hell. Now, they're all in hell, and the priest looks over at the rabbi, and he said, why are you here? And he said, a next-door neighbor fixed pork chops and invited us over for supper one night. Got a taste for it. I guess that's the reason I'm here. And he looked at the priest, and he said, what are you doing here? He said, that celibacy thing, I never could quite get that down pat. So they looked at the Al-Anon, and they said, well, what are you doing here? And she said, what do you mean? And they said, well, what did you do to get sent to hell? She said, it's not hot and I'm not here. And that's sort of the way I was. Sister, haven't you ever been into something and say, this cannot be happening. This is not real. I'm going to wake up and this is going to be a dream. Now, in my inventory, I found that I started doing this when I was 12 years old. The first thing I did was I decided that my father wasn't dead, that he was just hunting, and he was going to come home, and everything was going to be all right, because I could not accept that fact. And whenever my reality would get so bad I couldn't stand it, I would go off into the fantasy of denial. I think sometimes denial saves your sanity, but it will also take it at the same time. You can't cope with what it is. You will move over to where you can cope. And so I had to go back. So it's very hard to get back over here to where the truth is. When you live in denial, which is a lie, by the way. Denial is not the truth. Okay. In the 12 and 12, it talks about blaming other people, and it talks about changing yourself to meet conditions as they are. It never occurred to me to adjust myself to the conditions as they were. I fought to change the conditions in other people. I was always in conflict with people about me. I don't know about you, but I had some very sick relationships, and they didn't have to be close relationships. When I was in Newfoundland, I had a very sick relationship with my landlady who lived next door. Now, true enough, going through the bottom of her house didn't help anything. But like, for instance, I'm impatient. And I told her I wanted a window in my bathroom. I went to the base, got it okayed. I can have a window in my bathroom. The day I came in and told her that, she did not put a window in my bathroom. So the next day, found me with a chopping axe. And I made a hole in my wall so that I got a window put in my bathroom. Now, you know, that's pretty wild when you think about it. It makes a hell of a noise when you're chopping a hole through a house to the outside. But I got a window in. This did not endear me to my landlady. She didn't like the way I paid my rent. So she told my husband that she wanted him to bring it over instead of me. And I said, no, we won't do that. That's what she wants. I said, I know what we'll do. I'll take it down to the post office. Well, I had a car and she didn't. And they did not have door-to-door delivery, which meant she would have to go to the post office 4.5 miles away to pick up her rent check that I could have given her because I lived next door to her. I was not in good feeling with my people around me. And I laughed about it every time she would go off with her little snowshoes on and her little boots with her little cap pulled down over there. I'd say, the old bitch is going after the check. She could have had it next door, but she pissed me off. So you see, I had a tendency for revenge. I didn't like her. Now, revenge can get you killed if you're not careful. And I did some very crazy things under the guise of revenge. J.D. had a little MG sports car. A little MG midget. The kind that I would put on and take off. When you're my size, you do not get in and out of an MG midget. And my hair was real long, and I had it up on top of my head, and every time you'd get in that darn car, your hair was hanging off to the side. I never got out of it that I didn't get my feet hung in the steering wheel. It was not a happy car. I didn't like it. And so I would tell him when he would go zipping off to work, I'd say, don't leave me the MG. I want the big vehicle. And he would get even. And he'd take the big truck and leave me the little teeny car. Well, it was my grocery day, and I was going to go pick up my girlfriend, and we were going to get groceries in the little teeny car. Now, I weighed about 250, 60 pounds, and Reba weighed over 300. And when I pulled up at her house, she was standing there going, now, you know, our book talks about the determined Al-Anon. And I said, Reba, come on. I said, you can get in this car. And she said, there's no way. I said, we will do it. I said, now, I found that if you turn sideways and just sort of fall in and then pull your feet around, that'll work. Well, I got her in sideways, but I like to never got her turned around in that little bucket seat. And then getting the door shut, because it's in the wintertime, we had on our coats and everything. It was really a strength. And then when I got in the car and started to drive it off, I got very familiar with her when I was shifting gears. But I said, we're going to go to Safeway's anyway. He thinks that I'm not going to be, and I'll show him. So I went up to Safeway's. Now, if it's not hard to get in, do you know how hard it is to get out of one of those things? Because you're down now. So I crawled out, got hung in the steering wheel as usual, crawled out, got around on the other side, opened the door for her, and she said, I'm sick. Somehow there'd been a vacuum created. And I said, Reba, get out of that car. She said, I can't. I said, you will. Now, we had begun to draw an audience. And there was this one frisky little old black dude, and he's going, Lord, have they called a fire department? And I said, here's where I kill me one. Well, I got my foot braced on the door and one on the frame, and I'm got like this, and I'm jerking. And finally, she comes loose real quick. And she fell out on top of me in the parking lot. So we're rolling around out there in the parking lot. Now, we went in and bought groceries. I don't know where we thought we were going to put them. You know, the trunk is about the size of the glove compartment. But we got back out there, and we had the stuff, and we took it out of the sacks and was laying it in the floor and the floorboard. We had that stuff, and well, we finally got her put in and turned around and shoved off, and we went about a block and a half and broke the axle. Now, J.D. said later there was a 500-pound weight allowance on that car. And I said, well, that's what you get for leaving it. Well, now, he came home. He was unhappy because his little baby was down. And we went to get his little baby out of the ditch where I'd pushed it. You can do it one-handed. They're not really hard. Especially when you're mad. And we came up there with that big GMC, and it was misting rain that night. And he said, honey, I'm going to put this chain on here. And it's about 6-8 foot long. He said, now let me tell you how to tow a car like you ain't got enough sense for nothing. Don't you hate for somebody to tell you how to do something you know how to do? And they tell you 4 or 5 times? I'm one of those. I'll do that to you every time. So he was telling me how to do all this stuff. And I'm sitting there and I'm saying, yes, 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 I know. And he said, now whatever you do, don't floorboard it. I know that. So, I say it was cold. The automatic choke was on. So I thought, well, all I need to do is just take my foot off the brake because the choke will give it enough. And it did. And it jerked him sort of sideways and broke the chain. Well, he got out of the little car. He stomped up to me and he said, you floorboarded it. I said, no, I didn't. He said, I know you did. I said, I didn't. And he called me everything but a human being right there in the middle of the street when I was just there to help him, for God's sake. So he tied the chain on. Well, it's a lot shorter now than it was a while ago. And I'm sitting there as he goes back, and I thought, you know, I've already taken the whipping for this. It ought to be for free. So this time when he got in, I floorboarded it. And sure enough, I mean, it flipped him completely sideways out of that ditch. He broke the chain again. And he came out there, and he was just hysterical. And he came up, and he said, what? And I said, now that's what happens when you floorboard it. Do you see the difference? So he tied the chain on again. Now it's real short. And he said, whatever you do, don't stop fast. Because if you do, I'll be in the tailgate of the truck. Well, I know at this point there's nothing I'm going to do to please him. So I just decided, why bother to stop? So through the stop signs and the lights, he's going home without stopping. Well, he was a little hysterical when we got home. And he called me everything again, and he said, never in the echoing corridors of time will I have you told me. Never. And somehow inside of me I said, I bet you will. There'll come a day, and when that day comes, you better hope. 3 years later, you see, I have infinite patience. He's out at his mother's with that same little ratty-ass sports car. And I have a big station wagon with a 425-horsepower engine now. And he calls and says, my fuel pump's out of whack. Would you mind towing me home? And I said, no, not at all. And I hung up the phone and I went, oh, he's mine. God, it's so good. So I went out and I tied on and he still got that little short piece of chain. And when I would look in my rearview mirror, I couldn't see the front end of his car at all. I could see his windshield and his little face. And you know, he got him up there and he gave me all the directions again. And I just sat there and said, okay. And ever serenely, I went out of that driveway pulling that little car until I got to the main highway. And when I turned on it, I went 80 miles an hour. And the little smoke was running out from behind his little wheels, and he was trying to put the brakes on. And he was going like this, and I could see him, and I was going, yeah! Past 3 cars at one time. Don't you love it? Got home. Now, From his mother's to our house was about 17 miles, and we made it in about 12 minutes. He got out of the car and cried in the front yard. Now, the insanity here, you realize not only did I risk our lives, but everybody else that was on that road. I risked everybody. Why? To get even with him. Because he had hurt my feelings. He insulted my intelligence. So, that was just one of many times that I got revenge. Okay. I had problems, like I say, with a lot of people. And I began to look at those as I began to come to that inventory. Things that I had done. And you know, it's real easy. When you look at what they did to you, when you know how we like to blame, you say, well, they did this to me. What did you do to them that caused them to do that to you? That's how I had to turn that around and take a look at that. Because a lot of times, these people were just doing what I'd ask for every bit of this stuff that I got. I was as sick as my secret. All these things that I had done that I hoped the living soul would never know. You know those things that you want to carry to the grave with you? That you'd just die if somebody knew. Those things made me sick because, you see, as long as you have those kind of secrets, you're always going to have fear. What if somebody finds out? What if? One of my biggest fears was the fear of rejection. God, I wanted to be loved. I wanted that kind of feeling that I had with my daddy. I wanted that feeling of security. And I looked to people to give me this kind of feeling. And I was so afraid that if I told you things about me and if I was really me with you, that you wouldn't love me because I didn't love me. So I had to be careful that I didn't let you get too close. And when I would see you were getting too close, I'd have to do something to destroy that relationship so that I could move on and wonder why in the world you didn't love me. When you fear being rejected, chances are you reject first because that way you protect yourself. Okay, I had terminal uniqueness. You know, there's nobody in the world that's done the things I've done. God loved me. I have been, you know, I used to say, things happen to me that never happened to another living soul. And that's true. It's because I put myself in places nobody else would ever do. I put myself in these sick situations. And then I would have to pay the consequences of doing that. But the healing begins in the fourth step. When I begin to write all this down, and I think it has to be written, because if you don't write it down, you'll justify it away. And when you've got it down there in black and white, it's a lot easier to see the nature of the wrong. Now, there were a lot of similar incidents, but the nature of the wrong was the same that caused every one of these incidents. So it's not what you've done so much as why you did what you did. Because, you know, we can stop doing a lot of things we've done, but you will not be able to stop why you do it until you recognize that. So you have to peel off these layers. I had to get down to that pure, unadulterated truth. And then money. That was a big area for me. Money and its importance to my life. My mother was always a and my daddy was a spendthrift. And because I thought Daddy was so good, I decided to follow his example and become a spendthrift. Now, during the drinking, I blamed J.D. for all of our financial insecurity. It's real easy. You know, they're spending a lot of money on booze and fines and stuff that goes along with the drinking. But now I'll give you an instance. You know, J.D. would go out and spend money we didn't have, and it would make me mad, so I'd go to the mall. Now, if we don't have money for him to go out and drink, why do we have money for me to go to the mall? We don't. And here was the horrible truth. J.D. got sober, and his drinking money situation ended. 5 years later, we're paying off my charges at the mall. You know, so who was having more financial instability? I was. I had to learn something about myself, and that is that I am impulsive when it comes to buying stuff. I'll just go through the mall. You know, I find that it's better for me not to go shopping or to know exactly what I'm going for. I'm not one of these that can go to the mall for the weekend and say, let's go Saturday and just go shopping and spend a happy day looking at stuff all up and down. I couldn't, it would take a tractor trailer to carry out the stuff that I would see if I gave myself that privilege. Right? So I have disciplined myself to go and know what I'm going for. Go to that department, get it, and get the hell out of Dodge. You know, don't cheat yourself by stopping and browsing. Because the minute I see it, I want it. And if I want it three times, it becomes a necessity. Don't you ever have that? I want that, I want that. God, I need that. I can't live without that. And I had a lot of that at home. And you know what's amazing to me was, now in looking back, what did I do with all that stuff? I usually didn't care for it after I got it home. My pride wouldn't let me take it back, so I gave it away. So I just blew money away. Okay? The things in my inventory that I did were not nearly as important as my feelings about the things that I did. I think a lot of times we get hung up on what we do, but it's not what you do, it's how you feel about what you do. Because it's those feelings that make you sick on the inside. What you do is bad enough, but you know, you do it one time maybe, but how many times do you beat yourself for it? Over and over and over and over. So this is what I needed to look at. What were my motives? What was the exact nature? I had so much anger, hate, revenge inside of me. By the time I came to Al-Anon, I could not identify any feeling except anger. If you hurt my feelings, it made me mad. I didn't feel self-pity. I got mad. If you didn't do what I wanted you to, it made me mad. Everything made me mad. If I had a good day, it made me mad that I didn't have a good day yesterday. If I had a bad day, I was so happy because I was mad. I had a reason to be mad. I was mad all the time. And I rained on people. Now, do you ever take out your anger on inappropriate people? You know, I'd get mad at my husband. I'd be at the grocery store and the poor clerk at the grocery store. I'd look at her and I'd say, you shortchanged me a penny. You weighed that too much. You had your hand on the scale. Can't you count? I would take out my anger on people. I'd be driving down the road. I'm mad. Why am I mad? Well, I'm running late. Why am I running late? You know, that was one of the things that always amazed me. Have you ever noticed why every fool in the world gets in front of you when you're running late? Every slowpoke in the world. Now, I've got a newsflash for you. I've checked this out, and it's the truth. They're there the same time every day. The difference is you're not at the right time. If you weren't in a hurry, you'd never notice the fact they were going slow. You know, it's not them. It's you. And that's what I had to recognize. That when, you know, if I'm running late, you know why I'm irritated? Because I'm running late. I have no thought about how it's affecting you. That's some of my self-centeredness. That's it would say, the world is so important. I'm so important in this world that the world can wait on me. That's one of the best forms of self-centeredness there is having other people to have to wait on you to make your grand entrance. Okay. And if you're not sorry for your conduct and it continues to harm others, you're going to get sicker and sicker and sicker. It tells the big book that the people, if their conduct continues to harm others, they'll go back and drink. And ours, it will just get sicker and crazier. And we keep hurting people, too, with our behavior. Okay. This step was your identifying step. You're uncovering who you are so you can discover what you are. So now that you can be willing to discard the things that you find that are not good. You will find, believe it or not, if you're doing this correctly, you will find you have some good points, too. Be sure that you're not taking a negative inventory. Surely there's going to be some negative things, but there's nobody in this world who is all bad. There's good in the worst of us, and there's bad in the best of us. So if you will remember that when you put it down, you're trying to find the truth. And the truth is we're a combination of good and bad. I found that I had awfully good intentions. Unfortunately, other people judge me by actions. You know how you intend to do this but never get around to it? Or you didn't intend for it to go this way, but it did. You know, my intentions sometimes were very far removed from my actions. Okay, I had a lot of fear. A lot of fear. I realized I was afraid of storms. That wasn't too hard to recognize. That's, you know, in Arkansas, we're part of the Tornado Alley. And I would find myself in a quivering mass in my closet, absolutely terrified, to the point that I couldn't function. I would be sick at my stomach with fear when the tornado siren would come on. Now, it's normal to be concerned and a little apprehensive when a tornado siren comes on, but I would go into such a state of fear that I could not have functioned if the tornado had come. There was no way. I was afraid of the dentist. I didn't want people to know that I was afraid of a dentist. You know, that's little kid stuff. I was a little kid. I was afraid of heights. I was afraid. You know, it's so funny. I used to say, the whole world, my life is an open book. Just don't tell my mother. I was terribly afraid of my mother. And I hated my mother because she didn't love me. And I was so fearful that people, that my mother would find out. And then, you see, I kept trying to get her approval. And that's the reason I didn't want any mother ever find out the things I did, because I knew she wouldn't approve of me. And it's funny how we go and we search and we look for those things. And that's all I wanted, was for my mother to love me, but she didn't love me. Okay. I got the inventory all written down, and that was time to do that fifth step. And I knew I had to do it real quick or I'd chicken out. So I think it's a pretty good idea that when you get toward the end of your inventory, you call to make an appointment so you can get your fifth step done. That way you have less tendency to put it off, procrastinate, and just chicken out. You know. And so I don't know what I thought was going to happen that day. And I don't know how your fifth step was, or if you haven't had one, how it will be. But mine was just the way it was supposed to be for me. I don't think that all fifth steps are alike, just like all four steps are not alike. Because all people are not alike. But I feel that if we are asking God's guidance, we're going to get what we need at the time. And when I went to do my fifth step, Luke, I was out of town. And I knew I had to hurry up and do it. Now, there's no one that knows me as well as Bluebell, except for one other lady in our group, but I couldn't possibly do that with her because she was the one I went to. She was like a co-sponsor because she was a real goody-two-shoes. She was one of these little sisters that was knocking on the church door every time it rattled, and I mean, you know, she was just really, really, really good. You know. And I knew she wouldn't understand these things that I had written in here, a lot of these things, and I was very fearful. But for some reason, her name kept coming up to my mind, so I called her, and she said, I'll tell you what, I'll pray about it, and then you pray about it, and we'll get back together tomorrow, and we'll talk about it. And so I told her that I still felt that she was the person that I was supposed to go to. And I know today she was, and why? Because, you see, I knew that Bluebell loved me and accepted me as I was. And I was not a nice person to Bluebell many, many times, as you know. But this person, I didn't really want them to know how bad I was. I knew that Bluebell would accept me. But I needed to realize that other people could accept me also. So I went to Kathy that day, and we started off, she said, we're going to get on our knees, and we're going to pray. And I was not used to praying aloud or anything with anybody except occasionally with J.D., and so I was a little fearful, but there seemed like a peace that sort of came over us as we settled down, and she asked God to reveal to me what I needed to know about me, and for me to realize there would be no condemnation in that day. So I was not going to be condemned for anything that we were going to find. And then I began to talk with her and read to her my four steps. And lo and behold, as I would go through it, this was the most marvelous thing, was she began to share of her life and experiences from her fifth step back with me. And she said, you know, you haven't done anything I haven't done, thought about doing, and wanted to do. And I said, you can't mean that. I mean, here you are, and you're so good. She said, you wouldn't believe the thoughts I have. And she began to share with me some of the thoughts. And I could realize then, I began to feel that uniqueness leaving and to realize I was just another person. I was just another human being who had been sick and who was now beginning to... That was a healing experience for me. Now, when I left her house that day, we got on our knees and we prayed again before he left, and she prayed a really strange prayer then. She asked me to ask God to forgive me for those things.
She asked me to accept that forgiveness, and she asked God to have her forget. To forget all the things that she had heard me share that was not necessary for her to remember. And you know, that gave me a feeling of peace. I didn't worry then about her going off and blowing her guts about something I said. You know, it's very important that you have that trust. And so I needed to hear that because I was a little fearful that she might share. Because, you know, we're sick people or we wouldn't be here. And it was a terrifying thing to me. The guilt that I had when I went in there had been relieved. I think doing fifth steps with people is probably one of the greatest honors that you can ever do a person. Is to ask them to share in your life the real you, how you really are. And the relief does not come from the confessing sins of others. I had to be real careful with that because even in telling my fifth step to her, I had a tendency to want to say, but look what they did to me over here. And she said, you don't get better by confessing theirs. You get better by confessing yours. And I said, well, why can't I just tell her part of it and this one over here part of it and this one over here? You know, we have people at home, they'll say, well, I've done an inventory. I've talked to this one and this one and this one. Because nobody ever gets to know who you are. And I needed one person to be able to know who I was 100%. Because that's within the kind of person I am with my ego the way it is. When I tell you everything that's wrong with me, that in itself is going to be an incentive for me to do something about that. Because I know that you know. And also, I'm coming completely clean with one person. I'm not having to tell four or five people, and God forbid they ever get together. You know? Okay. I have known people that wanted to take an inventory with, say, believe it or not, there was a girl in our group that took her in fifth step with her husband. Now, you know, I'm a firm believer that we have no right to dump our garbage on our loved ones. And that's what I was doing all those years. I was carrying around this little gunny sack of garbage, and when I was with people, I opened up my little gunny sack of garbage and shared it, because that's all I had. That's all I had was this garbage from my past. And I don't think that a loving spouse or a loving family member would do that to their other family member. Because there's a lot of things that were in my inventory that would cause great pain to the person I live with. And it was not necessary. And from what I know he did, God forbid I should know more. Because it's hard enough to get healed from what you know about without having to go and beg for more garbage to be heaped on you. So I would not recommend taking an inventory with a family member. I personally think that for the best result, you should take it with someone in our fellowship. Now, I know there are a lot of clergy persons out there that are wonderful people and all like that, but if they are not in this program themselves, if they are not working the 12 steps for themselves, I don't think they know like we do what we need from this inventory. I don't think that they... Now, that's just how I feel about it, and if you've taken one with one, that's fine, but I'm just saying this is how I feel. I just don't think that somebody who's not doing what I'm doing will know what I need to get out of it. When we got through and we prayed and I got up, now we destroyed this garbage and we put it in the garbage. That's what we did. We put it in the garbage can, ripped it up. And as we ripped it up, she had me to say, she said, it's a little symbolical thing, but she said, when you tear it up, I want you to say, this is the garbage of the past. I'm putting away the garbage of the past. It can no longer hurt me. There was something freeing about doing that as I would tear up those things. All that stuff that I felt like I'd die if anybody found. And she said, now when you got through, she said, you know, you've got a clean sheet of paper to write on here. Don't go and garbage it up. You've got a new lease on life. And how many times in our lives had we thought we would move to another place and we would start over? But we carried that garbage with us. But now for the first time I could be where I was. I didn't have to move to another place. But I had moved to another place inside. And I had moved away. I had been cleansed of that garbage. I no longer had that garbage. I had shared it with another person and my God, the world went on. Isn't that amazing how you wake up the next morning and the world's still there? And that's something she said now. Everything, everybody else is just like they were today, yesterday, and what have you. You have an opportunity to be different. She said, you're going to have the same kind of problems and the same kind of situations come upon you, but you have an opportunity to be different. That was so freeing. When I left there, I felt cleansed. I felt closer to God than I had ever felt because I felt worthy of God's love now. I had put all that garbage to the past, away. I'd asked God for the forgiveness. And lo and behold, a lot of the pain was gone. I had gut-wrenching pain when I was riding that four-step and talking to her. And I hurt, and that was gone. And then she told me, she said, now go back home and read page 75 of the big book. And then go on to step 6 and 7. And it was here, when I went back home and I sat there and I read that, I felt like God was there with me. I felt like a child of God. I felt worthy. I felt clean and I felt whole. But I didn't do what she said. I didn't go on to 6 and 7. I think a lot of us take a vacation after the 5th step. We're wrung out, we're tired, and we say, ta-da, I've done my 4th and 5th step. Now let me tell you what the problem is with that. You know what's wrong with you for the first time, and you ain't doing a damn thing about it. And the awareness will not help you that much. Did you know I can be aware that I'm a certain way? Just like I can be aware that I'm impulsive when I go to the mall, and that won't keep me from going to the mall. I had to have something that was going to give me the courage not to go to the mall. I had to have help because by myself I couldn't do that. Now, here are all these character defects and all these things. Now, God knows that you're not going to want to get rid of them any more than you want to right after a 5th step because you're clean. But just sit down. Because we really, I looked at it and I said, I read that and I said, is that all there is? Is that all there is? Just reading that little paragraph? No, that's not all there is. Are you willing to change? That's what I had to say. Are you willing to change? The 6th step is the first evidence of our willingness to change. The 4th step is not willingness to change. That's willingness to take a look. Just to see what you're all about. But the 6th step is your first willingness to change. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. In other words, are you willing to live without the defects of character? Are you ready to learn how to live a new way so you don't have to practice them all the time? Now, how did you use your defects of character? They were my coping mechanism. If you back me into a corner, I'd lie. Okay? I use these things. These are my friends. They're hard to get. Well, I mean, do you tell the truth all the time? You know, there's rigorous honesty. I thought I'd have a rigor trying to be honest, you know. I said, I know why it's that way. It's true. If I'm not willing to change, I'll go right back where I began. And I'll start filling a new garbage bag. Because I've got no other choice at that point. You're either going to have to go forward or you're going to go back to what you know. And let me tell you, going back to the known is the easiest thing in the world. You don't have to do anything. You will automatically go back. And to try to live over here and do it different is the hardest thing you're ever going to have to do in your life. It's just to be willing to live different. You're going to have to put a little effort with it. It's very simple, but it's real hard to do. So I looked at these character defects and I said, if I have to live without these, I'm going to be totally vulnerable. People can hurt me. Did you know it's much easier for me to get over people hurting me than it is when I hurt me? Because I'll beat me over and over and over. I won't beat you, but I'll hit me. Why did I do that? How could I do that? I knew better than to do that. I should have done different. Don't shit on yourself. It's horrible. But I would do these things to myself. Now, you got to become entirely ready to give it up. Let's just take dishonesty. Now, was I a bald-faced liar? Sometimes. But not most of the time. Most of the time, it was a little just exaggeration. I mean, what's the harm in a little exaggeration? You know, what's the harm in just a little half truth? It's a whole lie. That's what's wrong. I'm driving down the road, and a car pulls out over here, and I have to slow down to let him in. That's boring, isn't it? But if I get to meet him and tell you, car almost ran me off the road a while ago. I swerved off to the side, just barely got it back in. That's all I would tell you, that little incident that happened. And that was because I was addicted to the attention. So I made everything a big deal so that you would notice me. And it was real hard. And it didn't come overnight. And every once in a while, I'll still zip off over there. Because I'm not well. I'm not well. Now, I also found that sometimes my brain has the ability to bypass. And I hear stuff the same time you do. It just sort of happens. It happened to me not long ago. I was, this was a big exercise for me. I was working the TI booth at the mall. They were all out there. And this other girl, JD had told me before I left, he said, if you're out there, check in at Sears. Sears loves me, you know. And he said, go over to the paint department and see if they have some sealer for our fountain and our bird bath. And I said, okay. So when we were relieved, we went into Sears, and we were just walking along there. And I had no idea this was going to happen. I walked into the paint department, and the guy's standing there, and he said, may I help you? I said, do you know anything about paint? Because, you know, a lot of times they have people in that department that don't know anything about what they're doing. And he said, yes, ma'am, I'm supposed to. And I said, congratulations, I am a Sears personal shopper, and it is my duty to examine you on the proficiency and the efficiency of your department. You have your test question for today is, if you were to have a customer who came in and wanted to know about sewer for a bird bath and or a water fountain, what would you suggest? And he grabbed his little book and he began to look through it real quick, you know. And the girl that was with me is going. And he said, this is what I use. I said, congratulations, that is the correct answer. I would like a gallon. And he looked at me sort of strange, and I said, if you would be so kind to give me your name and employee number, I will be able to fill out my report. And he gave it to me. And I picked up my gallon, and we're walking out. And Jennifer turns to me, and she said, I didn't know you worked for Sears. I said, I don't. And she said, well, why didn't you warn me? And I said, you heard it the same time I did. I don't know why that happened. It's sort of like you're playing a game and you just want to see how far it's going to go and where it's going to end. And she said, and I hate Jennifer, you know, she's so sweet and naive and wonderful. And she said, well, wasn't that dishonest? And I said, yes. And she said, well, what are you going to do about that? And I said, well, Jennifer, I'm going to write Sears and tell them about the nice young man in the paint department who was so helpful. I said, that's how I'm going to make an amends for that, because I don't feel like I hurt that little boy. And I said, maybe that's justification and rationalization, but I said, I can swear to you, I did not have one idea that was going to happen until I heard it. Now, I don't know what kind of defense that you would take against a mind like that. So I'm here to tell you, I'm still sick. But at least the sickness that I'm doing today is not harmful to other people. Like it once, I mean, you know, I didn't have to bite it till dinner. Okay. Another thing I found about myself that I was going to have to give up was arrogance, that acting superior. And a lot of times I didn't feel I was acting. I looked at people and found them wanting a lot. That was one of those cases where I was over-educated beyond my intelligence. But you see, this was another shield that I would put up to protect me from you. I had a lot of things that I did to protect me from you. And I had to become willing to learn to live without doing these kind of things. And it's hard, and it's scary. But you have to try over and over and over. Over and over. And what was my best motivator for wanting to change? Pain. Pain is always, when I hurt so long practicing a particular defect that I can't stand to get hurt like that anymore, then I'll generously give it up. You know? And I would be willing to give God those defects. Now, the anger. Anger was very hard for me to give up. I was willing to give up physical violence. That was hard too. I enjoyed physical violence. Have you ever noticed how that when you're really, really mad, if you can do some physical activity, it just lets it go? Well, if you can punch people out, it just really goes quick. And I enjoyed that. But I blamed everybody for my anger whenever anything went wrong. It wasn't them, it was me. Prime example, I sent away for a preserved fern. Now, a preserved fern is a real fern that they've done some little weird chemical process to that you don't ever have to water it, feed it, nothing. You just plunk it in a little straw basket and forget about it. Doesn't have to have light, doesn't have to have water. And I paid a king's ransom for this fern. And it came in this box with these long fronds and this little basket and this little hanger to hang it with, one of these little rope macrame type things. And I asked J.D. to help me with that fern. Mistake number one. Needless to say, communication was not one of our biggies. I got all these little things arranged, and it was just gorgeous. It was just draping. It was just absolutely fantastic. And I said, here, hold it. Now, what I meant when I said hold it was hold the flower pot. Hold the little basket. So I can put the little macrame thing on it. But that's not what I said. I said hold it. He did. He held the little hanger, and I held the hanger. Now, the fern hit the floor. Now, are you familiar with airplanes on an aircraft carrier deck? You know how the little wings are folded up? That's the way the fern fronds went out and down, like that. You know, they were just broken, just in the little, and it was horrible. And I looked at it, and I couldn't believe that happened. It was all his fault, because he hadn't held the pot. And my same reaction to this was, I stomped the fern to death in the carpet. I just did a little tap dance, like this. All over my fern. It didn't help anything. He looked startled. And I felt like an idiot. I could no longer justify that kind of behavior. And I looked at him and I said, I didn't make myself clear. I meant hold the pot. He said, I didn't understand it. I said, I know. But that before would have caused physical violence. It did to the firm. And I begin to realize that that kind of behavior was like a little kid. You know, when a little kid doesn't get their way, they have a little stomping fit. At least I used to. So, had one there. I became willing to not do it that away and to get rid of the anger. I became willing, and I said, God, how can I get rid of anger? Well, how I got rid of a lot of these things, I have not been relieved of anger. I have been relieved of the anger that would cause physical harm to people, places, and things. I think nowhere in the book does it show where anybody has ever been removed of all of their character defects, or any. But you will have enough of a particular defect removed that you will be socially acceptable. Okay? I was not socially acceptable, you know. Okay. And it says, no matter how far you progress, you will have desires which oppose the grace of God. And I thought that this feeling I had, a lot of these defects would be removed, and they'd be removed once and for all. Take the one that would say, let's be unfaithful. That one I asked God, I was more than willing to have that one removed. And I hadn't had any problem with it for years, and then all of a sudden one day I was attracted. And I said, oh God, that defect is back. Now, I have a choice. Do I follow through with that, knowing full well what the consequences are? I want to. But see, your mind will reflect back on how exciting that was. It's like with the alcoholic forgetting the consequences of the drink they took, only remembering the pleasure, how good it tasted. And I sit there and I played with that for a day or two, and I knew that the longer I played with that, the more dangerous I was getting. So I called and I asked if this person would pray for me, that I had the urge to do something I knew I shouldn't do. And I wouldn't tell her what it was, but see, I was ashamed that you could be an Al-Anon and still have these kind of feelings, for God's sake. And she said, okay, I'll pray. And it didn't do me much good, because you see, I was keeping it a secret, going right back and keeping it secret. So I called her back in a day or two, and I said, I'm going to tell you what this is, because it's getting stronger. And she said, okay. And I told her what it was, that I'd been attracted to this person, and they seemed to be attracted back, and it was not a very good situation. And she said, I'll pray. And I said, she said, what do you want me to pray for? And I said, you pray for God to remove from me the desire to do something I know I shouldn't do. Because I alone do not have the strength to do it myself. And so some time went by, and I was put in the proximity of this person, and I was sitting there reading my One Day at a Time book, and he said, what are you doing? And I said, I'm reading a One Day at a Time book. He said, what's that? And I said, well, it's a book for the families and friends of alcoholics. And he said, my God, people bitch about people drinking all the time. I tell you what, this whole world's down on poor people that drink. And he just, and I thought, he's one of them. No wonder I was attracted to him. And I laughed because the desire had been removed. So that's what I'm saying, you know, when you become entirely ready to have it. And I became entirely ready when I became entirely ready to become clean and tell her what the nature of the problem was. Okay, now we go on to step 7. Now, just becoming ready, don't get it. You got to do more than just speak ready. Then you've got to humbly ask God to do it. Now, humbly doesn't mean God take this one. It doesn't mean giving him his orders. It means sincerely having humility in your heart, recognizing you can't do it by yourself. That you're going to become teachable to a new way to live so that you don't have to do it. That's all it means. It's just to become willing. Now, I found that for a lot of character defects, there's positive opposites. Something that's the opposite of what you're doing. So what I do is I pray and I ask God, and then I move over into the act as if. I go over and I remove myself from situations that I know have the power to hurt me. And that's what I was doing in this situation. I was moving myself away from that person because I knew he had the power to hurt me if I played that game. Those are sick games that we sometimes play with people. And you have to be willing not to play the game. So when I would find myself in a situation where I was getting mad at somebody, instead of staying there for the bitter end, I found I can walk away. I don't have to stay there. I don't have to keep putting myself into situations that hurt me. In that fourth and fifth step, I saw patterns of my life that I'd do this and this would happen. You don't have to keep going back because you know now what situations have the power to hurt you. And when you go back and you play that game, you get what you ask for. You're going to get hurt. You ask for it. You got it. You drive your Toyota. And that's the truth, because I've gone back and played silly games and gotten hurt, and I knew better. And that's because I asked for it. I didn't do what I was supposed to do. So, when I do my morning prayer, I do my step 3 prayer. And if you notice, at the end of the third step prayer in the big book, it doesn't say amen. The amen comes after the seventh step prayer. So I say those two together, and I try to pray those two together instead of just saying them, but to listen to what they say and to do that and to ask God to remove any defective character that stands in the way of my usefulness to him or my fellow man this day, today. And you know, every day we're given opportunities to grow, to practice a defect or to practice recovery. We can live in the sickness or we can live in the recovery. I hear so many people say, but you don't understand. I was so affected by my father's drinking or my mother's drinking or my dog's howling or whatever. It doesn't make any difference how you got your ass in the mud. Get it out. Living in the sickness makes me sicker. Have you ever been to a meeting where you play Can You Talk This? They'll come in and say, oh my God, it was so bad at the house tonight. This one did this and this one did that. Well, you think that's bad. Let me tell you what happened over here. And I would sit there in those meetings and I would remember going back to the active alcoholism in my mind, and they would be talking about these things and they would go on, and I'd say, well, let me tell you what J.D. did one time. And I'd go home and I'd say, you are a scum-sucking pig. Get mad all over again because we're living in the sickness. I don't like to go to meetings where we live in the sickness or we say, has anybody got a problem? Who hasn't? Who cares? Has anybody got a solution? You know. You got to live in the solution. And so in our group, when somebody comes in and they say, oh, it's so bad over at my house, we have several little chorus that goes, 1, 2, 3. Poor baby. Who cares? And then we go on. You know, you get no sympathy in our group. All right, I had to become willing to give up fear. And this has been a real big thing for me, to become willing to give up fear. Because what will happen to you? You know, it's scary. Okay, the fear of storms. Fear is always scary, isn't it? I told God, I said, you know, I'm willing to give you that fear of those tornadoes because I can't stand what it's doing to my gut. I can't stand it. And what happened? We begin to have lots of tornadoes. How can you get over something if you ain't experiencing it? You know, how do you get patience? By being put in situations where you got to use it. Sponsorship's a real good area for that. We begin to have tornado after tornado, and I would just, I'd say, God, this is not what I meant. I meant take the tornadoes away. Take them away. And now that's not getting rid of the tornadoes. The fear of tornadoes, that's getting rid of tornadoes. And all of a sudden, one day, I'm sitting there meditating, and it hit me. It's not tornadoes that's killing me. It's the fear of tornadoes that's killing me. Tornado ain't hit me yet. Fear hits me every damn time. Now, how does that work? Well, the first thing that happens is they put that darn little blip signal on the TV. And they have, they got a little old funnel cloud. You know, God just makes you feel so good. Why can't it be an ice cream cone? You know, they shoot at our house. We should be afraid of those too. And I would sit there and I'd look at it, and pretty soon I can't see the picture. Now, it's only this tall, but all I can see is that tornado symbol. And then I'll go and turn on another TV on another channel just to get to see two of them. I turn on the radio and find out what they're doing on the radio. They say, well, it's coming up from Texarkana. See, Texas sends us tornadoes. And they seem to follow a path. And they come right up the interstate, right into Little Rock. So it said Arkadelphia. It's on its way to Camden. It's on its way to Camden. It's on its way to Saline County. Saline County's right next to Pulaski County. Pulaski County's where I live. By the time it would get there, I'd just be, you know, I would just be berserk. And then I couldn't get the damn dogs together to get them in the closet. They'd be biting on me. It was a nerve-wracking mess. And I found out, you know, one of the best things I could do? Turn off the TV. Don't turn on the radio. Don't feed the fear. Because, see, I have my little map there, and I'm getting more terrified the closer it gets. I'm mapping it right on up there. And by the time it had got there, I couldn't have done anything if I'd had to. But if I turn off the TV and turn off the radio and turn it over to God and ask Him to help me and then fill my mind with something else and get busy working on something else, then if the siren went off, I would say, I've got to get in the closet, and I'd go get in the closet. I would not feel like raising daisies in the closet, but I was not sitting in there just going to pieces. My heart wasn't, you know, my blood pressure wasn't shooting out. I wasn't ejaculating in the key of C. You know, I was just there. Okay. Now, went over to this little old place down a few miles out of Little Rock. Had supper with my sister one night. We got out to go get back in our car. The wind was blowing, the rain was coming, and I'm trying to get in the car door, and I can't hardly get it open from the force of the wind, and I am mad because I'm getting wet. We couldn't see how to drive. I had to pull off the side of the road and sit there. There's all sorts of debris in the air, and I said, "This is a mess, a mess." Went on down the road after a little bit, turned on the radio, tornado, a block away from us, the church was totally destroyed. I said, "Oh, my God, I was in the tornado." I'm okay. Even if the tornado comes, I'm okay. God can take care of you in the tornado. I'm okay. I've never found it necessary to go into that terror again. I could if I would play the game and feed the fear. But I know now what steps to take because God has given me the sanity to know what not to do so that I can be relieved of the fear of the storm. Now what about the dentist? Got the storms down. Now what about the dentist? How long has it been since you've been to this? Long time. Have very good teeth. It's a good thing. But you see, God knew I had to have good teeth. He knew I wasn't going to go to the dentist. I'm sitting at the hospital emergency room with my mother, who's supposedly having a heart attack, and my filling falls out. Bad news. I was more concerned about my filling than mother. As it turned out, she wasn't having a heart attack, but I did lose the filling. I go home from the hospital, and I said, "Now, you can do what you've always done and lose the tooth. You have a choice. Always before, you don't go when it hurts. After a while, you can't stand hot in your mouth. After a while, you can't stand cold in your mouth. After a while, you can't stand your tongue in your mouth. After a while, you can't stand the pain any longer. And then you go and they pull the tooth because there's nothing left. I'm not going to do it. I'm going to do something different. If you do what you've always done, you get what you've always got. I've always had the toothache and always lost the tooth. I'm going to do something different. I'm going to go to a dentist. Maybe they can't take me." So I got the phone book. I opened it up and the first little...